John from Menifee.
Hello, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. Let me get this situated. You can hear me in the back?
Yeah.
All right. You said no? Sarcasm?
Yes.
I know that language. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is October 23rd, 2008. I have a sponsor that knows he's my sponsor, and I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring several people in this program. I want to thank John for asking me to speak, and Mike for sending me the email reminder. I'd also like to thank all the guys that came out. John drove down with me from Menifee tonight, and then the rest of these guys, came out to hear me. I'm probably determined if I'm gonna tell the truth or not. What I always like to lead with anytime I get up and speak is I have a condition. My wife refers to it as resting dick face. And so what that really is, I'm a little nervous up here. I'm not nervous because I'm afraid of you. I'm nervous because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that the person standing in this seat right here, I'm standing up here on this podium, has the ability and is, uniquely qualified to help a certain person in this room. I don't know who it is. And to me, it really doesn't matter who it is. My goal and my hope for tonight is that one of you walk out of here, whether you're new, old, or, dust, is that you will get something that I'll be able to speak to you. Because I love Alcoholics Anonymous, it's given me a completely fantastic life that, I used to hear people get up and say, a life that I don't deserve. I believe the life I have, I deserve it because I've done the work. So along with the resting dick face, if you hear me say something that sounds funny, if I'm looking at you like I want to kill you, it's okay to laugh. When I was early in my life, if you'd asked me what I thought I was going to do, what my life was going to look like, I was going to marry the preacher's daughter. I wasn't sure which one yet, but it was one of them. We were going to have a couple kids, have a white picket fence. I was never going to cuss. I was never going to smoke. I was never going to have premarital sex, never going to drink alcohol. I was just, straight-laced. I grew up in a very strict religious household, a Pentecostal church. And, I had lots of memories of my dad, speaking in tongues. And, he would do this thing. You could hear it from anywhere in the church. He would just like, woo! Do this, just send chills up my back, you could always tell when somebody was new because they just about crapped their pants. And, I got used to it. And, when I was a sophomore, and my dad was a deacon in the church, and when I was a sophomore in high school, I found out that my dad had been cheating on my mom for 25 years of their marriage, and it completely gutted me. I never really had much of a relationship with my dad at all. I was a sports guy. My dad was a computer guy. I remember him I think he was putting Apple computers together before they had like a factory. They'd send him the parts, he'd put them together for whoever it was that was buying it. He was all about that and all about anything that wasn't sports. And I loved baseball, I loved football, and I would die to have my dad play catch with me. And the reality was it just felt like he never really had time for me. And so when I found out that he was having an affair on my mom, I developed a resentment against God, organized religion, my dad, and I created a bucket list of things I needed to do, because my dad told me that all these things are bad, don't drink, don't smoke, no premarital sex, but he's doing all this stuff, so it must have been fun. The first thing to go was swear words, and I sounded like a complete idiot. I don't think I made any sense at all, but it was like, whoa, I said shit, And it just felt different. And I got to tell you, man, I can't not say this. A couple years ago, I came here with my girlfriend, who is now my wife. She was the main speaker, And she gets up here, the first thing she says is like, man, it's like a cake glory hole right here. It's like cake just keeps coming out. And I'm just, it's speaking loud. I had to get it out. You can see why I married her. And man, so then not long, you know, at one point I was at work and this guy says, hey, do you want a drink after work? And no one had asked me that. And I said, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And he said, what do you want to drink? I don't know. I listened to country music. So I said, how about some Jack Daniels? And he brought me Jack Daniels wine coolers, you know, which if I'd have known that was going to be my first drink, man, I would ask for something else because it doesn't feel good saying that. But it did the trick. You know, I immediately felt that sense of ease and comfort that we talk about in here. My skin fit. There was a girl that I had a crush on. I could talk to her. Man, it just felt different. And the best part about it was the next day I went to work and everyone was talking about how funny I was. I was like, what? You know, people really didn't talk about me at all. And I could not wait to do it again. You know, and this went on all through high school. You know, we'd have a party on Friday and Saturday night. Sunday, you know, I can barely walk, and I'm asking people, when is the next one? You know, show up Monday morning for school. When's the next party? It's like, John, relax. It's the weekend's like 5 days away. We're good. Like, but I got to know, you know. So that was my life. And, you know, I managed to graduate high school. I went off to Wyoming for auto body and refinishing. And there I graduated with honors of perfect attendance. It was not because my drinking hadn't taken off. It was because, you know, I was convincing myself that I didn't have a drinking problem. Not long after that, I got wife number one pregnant. I'm numbering them for a reason. Got wife number one pregnant. And I decided that I was going to give up on the auto body refinishing career and join the Coast Guard. And so I joined the Coast Guard, and they asked me how much I drank. And I was honest with them because, quite honestly, it was kind of a badge of honor for me. You know, I was the guy that sounded like a janitor. You know, I'd carry the bottle caps in my pocket or the pull tabs. You know, how much have you had tonight, John? This much. And I pull it out and show them, you know. And they weren't as impressed in the military. They're like, we're kind of concerned about how much you drink. I'm like, not enough? Like, no, too much. And they said, well, you might want to, we just want you to kind of be mindful of that when you're in the military. It could really affect your career. I said, okay, noted. And I got to my first duty station. I went in the Coast Guard because my son I had just had a son that was born. And, you know, I was living in Ridgecrest, California. I don't know if anyone knows where that's out, in the middle of the Mojave Desert and just an absolute crap hole. And I got to get out of there. And so I joined the military so I could be a better father because I had something to prove with my dad and to be a provider. And I got stationed on an ice-breaking cutter that was deployed for 6 months down to Antarctica and up to the Arctic Ocean. So you can imagine my disappointment when I'm like, okay, I'm supposed to be a present father, and now I'm out to sea for 6 months. That first year in the military, I was actually out to sea for 9 months. When I was actually in Antarctica, it was, I think it was my birthday or the day before my birthday, I called back home to my wife and I said, hey, how you doing? You know, we're trying to chat with her and it's real cold and not cold, just the temperature, but she was cold. And, I said, what's up? Like something just feels weird. She says, well, we got to talk when you get home. I'm like, like 10,000 miles away from home. It's going to be a little while. Could you throw me a bone? And she says, well, I found somebody else and I want a divorce. And I had the same response, but I met a friend, and my friend was called Wild Turkey, and I gotta tell you, Wild Turkey and I went on a good run. And so then, fast forward a few years, my wife and I split. I got custody of my son. He was 3 years old at the time, and. I need to tell you that when my son was first born, I couldn't wait till he could hold a bat in his hand, and I'd throwing him wiffle balls in the house and, you know, getting him to play baseball because that's what I wanted, you know. And then after I got custody of him, I am coaching Little League. I met wife number two, you know, because when I'm in the military, got custody of my son. I was on a ship, and they said, They said, when you have custody of your son, you can't exactly deploy. I said, well, you got a point there. So they put me on land for a year. And on land, they basically put me on a humanitarian transfer. So I got to stay there for a year, provided I got to resolve my little problem of not being able to deploy. So I found wife number two. You know, that was the challenge I heard the military said. You got to find a wife. So I did. Married her. That lasted a very short period of time. But during that marriage, I bought a house, my first house out in Santee. And I promoted in the military, despite the fact that I went to alcohol treatment twice. The first time I went to treatment, I actually came to meetings here at this hall. This was back in 1998. I had just what I would call today a normal day. I was a shipboard firefighter and a welder, and I really screwed up a watertight door. You know, I made it screwed it up so bad that I warped the metal and we couldn't open the door. And I had a friend asked me, he said, what are you going to do tonight? I said, well, I'm going to get a bottle of Wild Turkey. I'm going to start drinking it. I'm not going to stop till I can't remember a damn thing about this day. And that's exactly what I did. I went to the 32nd Street package store, got a bottle, and went over to the barracks down at the Navy base. And I have vague recollections of that night. I do know I threw a fire extinguisher out the 12th story window at somebody in the parking lot. I was hitting on his girlfriend. He had a problem with it, so I figured I'd pick a fight with him from the 12th story. And the story is that I tried to throw a chair out the window, but I couldn't fit it out the chair or out the window. And then I remember leaving because the military police were on their way. And I remembered sitting down before I crossed over to the wet side of the base. And the next memory I had, I have a vivid image that my body is inside the ambulance and I'm watching the paramedics close the doors and I'm inside, but I can see from the outside. And I truly believe that I died, that was my spirit seeing that. And I realized that when I went to treatment that probably was true. This was back before, definitely before cell phones, well, before I had a cell phone. And people would just hand you your paper chart to go with you. And I've got my paper chart and I'm looking and I'm reading all the plaques on the wall and it says, you know, different levels of blood alcohol content. And mine was, they said 0.44, you're supposed to die. And I looked down at my chart said 0.46 BAC. And, you know, I'd love to tell you that was my sobriety date. It was not. What I took from that night was that I just shouldn't drink around non-rates because I was a petty officer. And they clearly couldn't handle their alcohol, you know. And so after wife number two, after we divorced wife number two, I met the team mom. I started coaching Little League and met the team mom. And I'm thinking, I got two divorces now under my belt, and I'm like, I don't know, 26 years old. I should probably slow it down, you know, maybe date for a little while. And so we dated for a while, but this woman drank like I drank. She could hold it down really well. And we got married, sold that condo, bought another house. And, you know, my life, I got out of the military in 2005, and I started drinking the green dried alcohol. And so I'd go from dried alcohol to wet alcohol, you know. Tried just liquor, tried just beer, tried wine because I hated the taste of it. But if you drink it fast enough, you can't taste it anyway, so it doesn't really matter. I went to church because I'm like, I gotta try to stay sober. I opened my own business as a general contractor in 2005. And alcohol was becoming a problem for me. I said, I'm going to go to church. And it was there that I learned how to brew alcohol. I met a few friends, and they're like, yeah, come on over for Memorial Day. And if you want to bring beer, it's fine. I was like, really? I came here to stop. And they taught me how to brew beer. I started brewing my own beer, and that still didn't do it. And, man, I'd love to tell you that this terrible horror story that my bottom was lower than a 0.46 BAC, and it wasn't. You know, my bottom was that I went from just a sole prop owner to owning a corporation with seven employees as a general contractor in a very short order. My last year in business before I got sober, I grossed over $330,000. I had a house. I had my work truck was paid for. I had my own truck was paid for. My wife's car was paid for. I didn't really want for anything. I had a garage full of tools. But on the inside, I wanted to die. On the inside, I was completely broken. And so I, when you, in my sobriety date's 2008. So if any of you are old enough to know what happened in 2008 with the housing market and construction. So 2005, everyone had Monopoly money. And you could, you know, just home equity line of credit. You betcha. I'll pay it later. And let's bring you in here and do some reconstruction. And 2005, that all kind of stopped. And so the combination of the economy and absolutely my drinking took effect of my life. And so what I did was I convinced myself, I told people I had made a decision to shut the business down. But the reality was I could still be in business today if I was sober because, you know, when I knew what I was doing and I had a good market. And so I got a job interview. I'm going to go do a job interview at a place. And how do you celebrate when you're an alcoholic and you get a job interview? You go out drinking. So I went out drinking. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the Ye Village Inn in Santee. Right? I got some patrons back there. And man, I would drive by that bar all the time. I'm not going to drink there. Only alcoholics drink there. And I found myself that night at the Ye Village Inn. And then it was like when before they mowed that across the street. I don't even know what's there, like a dentist shop or something, or CVS. But there was another bar across the street. So we closed the Ye Village down and we went across the street to some other bar. Long story short, I ended up inviting these guys back to the house and didn't know these guys, you know, and I'm drunker than a skunk. I wake up the next morning still drunk. And but I had been familiar, for me, so I wasn't alarmed by that at all. And so I went to the job interview, and I'm reading the guy. I've got his body language. I know I got the job. You know, we stand up to shake hands, and every pore of my body opened up, and the room smelled filled with the smell of alcohol. And his face turned white as a ghost, and he knew, and I knew that he had just wasted an hour of his life. And I walked to my truck, and I said, God, if you even effing exist, I need some help. I drove home, and my wife, she worked for the newspaper, and she was also too drunk. So she had called in sick. When I walked in the door, she was sitting on the bed looking up AA meetings on her laptop. And that was all I needed. You know, those two times in treatment, I came to meetings here. I went to meetings in PB all over the place, and they, you know, they weren't offering what I needed. You know, honestly, I was looking for women when I went to meetings in PB. You know, there was a cute girl that kept me coming back for a long time. I didn't hear anything about recovery, but sure flirted with her a lot. And I knew that this was where I needed to be. And so, we went to the Santee Saturday Night Speaker Meeting. And there was a guy standing at the podium like this. He was dressed like I am. And at the time, I didn't want anything to do with anybody wearing a suit. And when he started to talk, he spoke in a way that I knew that he drank like I drank. I knew that he felt like I felt. And I knew that he thought like I thought. But he didn't look anything like I did. He wasn't talking like I talked. And I knew I needed to have something. You know, but I'm the type of guy that I don't like to make quick decisions too quick. And so I walked out, and, you know, my wife was, she's kind of a bubbly personality, you know. And she's like, oh, I want to go thank the speaker. I'm like, no, let's go home. She goes up to the speaker and spills the beans that we're new. And then he pulled us back into the meeting and says, you're new and you don't have a sponsor? Nope. You got a book? Nope. That night I was assigned a sponsor, and I was handed a big book. And that man took me through the first three steps. You know, and I'm super grateful for something he said to me. He said, John, he says, sponsorship is not ownership. If you find that there's somebody else in this program that you think can help you better than I can, I want you to work with that person. And so I got to the fourth step. I looked at the fourth step on the wall, and I said, it's probably not a chance I'm going to be honest with you. But there was somebody else, you know, Bill M, if you happen to know him. He was, you know, he seemed like a cool guy. He surfed, and I didn't surf, but, you know, he seemed cool. And I asked him to sponsor me. He took me through the remainder of the steps. I really struggled with step four. I struggled with step four because I heard in meetings that it's the one that takes people out. You got to be perfect. You got to be thorough. And I wanted to get it perfect. And I'm sitting there racking my brain trying to figure out everything on that list. And I'm grateful that somebody said in a meeting, they said, John, it's not the things that you can't remember that are going to take you out. It's the things you can remember that you're not willing to put on paper. And I was instantly done with my fourth step. And I shared inventory. And then, you know, steps six and seven throughout the years have meant more and more to me. You know, as I said, I had a deep resentment against God and against organized religion. And so when I came in here, the first few times when I was in treatment, I would see God on the wall. I would say, nope, not a chance in hell. But at that Santee Saturday night speaker meeting, I heard the speaker say the F word and God in the same sentence. And I said, maybe the bar's low enough here. I can do this. And somebody pointed out in the book, says, why don't you choose your own conception of God? You know, there's a part in this book that said, deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It may be buried by pomp and, you know, all this other, I don't know the whole thing. And that was me, you know, because my experience of God and organized religion was, open your mouth, John. We're going to cram this down your throat. I was raised to believe that I should be afraid of God and that he was a punishing God. And I didn't like that. You know, when I started to learn, like, oh, wait, if I sin, but it seems like everything that's fun is sinning. What's the point of that? And so choose your own conception. So I had to blow out my understanding of God, my understanding of what I was raised to believe, because I didn't really get a choice. It was told, this is God, this is what it looks like, you take these things, take these actions. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the fact that this is not a religious program. You know, I hope it doesn't happen in this meeting, but one of the things that absolutely chaps my hide is when somebody stands up here and they do the closing prayer and they ask everybody to take their hats off. Like, I understand respect, but I learned that in church. And, if it's not a religious program, then why do we do religious things? So enough of that soapbox. I'm in a different part of the county. I got sober. I was here for 15 years, and I went to a different part, and AA is a little bit different. Yeah, so, all right. So choose your own conception of God. So I decided that my God is a 49er fan. Yeah, he cusses like a sailor, and he's hung like a Shetland pony. And that's a God that I can do business with. You know, it tells me that I need to surrender to something. You know, I heard people talk like, oh, surrender to a doorknob. Yes, maybe. You know, I sponsored a guy his first 5 years of sobriety. His higher power was the ocean. And, okay, that's powerful. And then little by little, he started to say, you know, John, I'm starting to notice these coincidences. And about the same time, I'm having also my kind of in-depth spiritual experience, the educational variety, like it talks about in Appendix 2. And so choosing my own conception of a higher power gave me the ability to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. I choose to use the acronym God, which is a gift of desperation for me, and that's exactly what I had when I came to this program. I didn't know how to stop drinking. I didn't know how to live my life without alcohol. It just seemed unfathomable. So So I want to back up a little bit to my son. By the way, it's also I want to share with you that there was a period of time when I told my dad, I said, you're dead to me. Don't write me. Don't call me. Don't even ask people about me. I didn't talk to my dad for over 12 years. And meanwhile, I'm simultaneously raising my son. I'm coaching a little league, you know, and I was just thinking about this. It was actually 2008. So I got sober in 2008. In like July of that year, I was coaching and managing the team. We won District 41 championship for minors with him. And in my mind, I'm thinking People Magazine is going to come interview me for Father of the Year. You know what my son said to me? He says, Dad, he says, I don't like baseball. You do. Yeah, I had the same response. It absolutely gutted me. Because in my mind, I was giving my son something that my dad never gave me. And I realized in that moment that I owed my dad an amends. I owed my son an amends. Because what I did was I left my son feeling the same exact way that my dad left me feeling. Because my son likes video games. I don't like them. They're too close to a computer. And so that was the first year that I let my son quit baseball. He tried all the pretty much every year. I was telling some guys earlier tonight. I said he would not do well in school. And I'd say if you don't get your grades up, you're not going to play. And then grades would plummet. Okay, we still got to get out there. So, you know, when I was in the military, there was a guy that a supervisor of mine that. I was a shop supervisor and he was head of me and he said to me, he said, John, he says, when you order something, I want you to order three of them. I want you to order one for yourself, one for me, and one for the shop. And then as these things started to appear, I started to recognize the ones that he had weren't staying in the shop, they were leaving. And I was like, wait a second, I could probably do that too. So I started doing that. And then he really upset me, so I turned him in. And what a jerk. Turned him in. And they did an investigation. Somehow he was hiding it all. And they said, John, we didn't really find anything, but because like you brought this up, we actually need to close this out. We need to come to your house and search your house. What? I wasn't prepared for that. So they came to my house and found a bunch of stolen goods. And I still got out with an honorable discharge, but they invited me to leave a few months early. And you know, steps 8 and 9 for me, you know, my dad was on my never list. I was never going to make amends to that man, ever. And when that happened with my son, I knew I owed an amends. And I contacted him, and I made amends to him. And not long after that, you know, he'd divorced my mom and then moved up to Oregon, and we kind of engaged with a little conversation here and there, and turns out he's having some marital problems, and I know a little bit about those. So out of my mouth, I heard myself say, "Hey, why don't you come down here and spend some time with me in San Diego?" And I was like, "Who the hell said that?" Tried to grab it before he heard it, and he said, "I'd love that, son." You know, he came down here and he stayed in San Diego for 2 weeks. I took 2 weeks off of work, and every single day I picked him up. He was staying in a hotel. I didn't live in a condition that my place wasn't large enough. And I picked him up and we went around looking at every secondhand store in San Diego. You know, he's a secondhand store kind of guy. And you know what I really wanted to do? I wanted to take him to a Padre game. I wanted to take him to the batting cages. You know, a bunch of play catch with him. But I learned that in here. And you know, he died a few years ago, and it was such a relief for me to know that I had put that to bed. I didn't have to carry that with me anymore. And you know, I had the opportunity to go back to the Coast Guard base, and the guy that I had snitched on was still there, and I went to the gate and I said, "Hey, I'd like to meet with you." And he says, "What do you want?" Not exactly the welcome I was expecting. And I said, "I just need to talk to you for a minute." Reluctantly, he agreed, and I met with him and I said, "Look, I that was wrong of me. I had no business to do that." And he said, "John," he says, "you have no idea the harm you caused for my family." He says, if I would have thought I could have gotten away with it, I would have killed you. And before the end of our talk, he said, John, if you ever need anything, let me know. He says, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it. You know, I also made amends for all the stealing. You know, that when the investigators came to my house, I was also stealing a lot of materials, and I'd built an island in my house and got some butcher block from the office, and we're standing around the butcher block island and we're having a conversation about the stuff that I'm like, man, the irony of this. And to go back there and to make amends for that was such a huge relief for me. You know, there's lots of other amends I'd love to tell you about. There was one time in particular, this was years after. If you're new, oh, by the way, congratulations to all the token takers. That's supposed to come out first. And welcome to the newcomers. Yeah. Welcome to anyone who didn't identify as new. I knew I probably wouldn't have been identifying early. If you're new and you're worried about the fourth step, you're going to have another opportunity. You may have another opportunity to do another inventory. And that's what happened for me. I was driving down the freeway one day, driving on 52, and I looked to my right, and there's a dude in this truck, and he's wearing Oakley sunglasses. And I remembered, man, in high school, there was a guy, you know, Chris F. He was a foster kid. And every year, it seemed like every year, he'd come back with a new last name after summer. And he was always spoiled. He always had all the stuff. And I didn't. I'm wearing Kmart shoes, you know. What's that Champion brand or whatever? What's the stuff that's like, it's popular now, but it wasn't back then? Yeah, Champion, right? And so we're on the baseball team, and we're both vying for a vital position on the bench. He takes his glasses off. He puts them on top of the dugout. And then after practice, he ran away. He said, I got to go to work. He ran away, and I'm like, whoop, pop those in my bag. And then it's sudden he's running back towards the field. He's like, I left my sunglasses. Where am I? I put them up here. Well, where are they? I'm helping him look for them. I'm the type of guy that will steal something from you and then help you look for it. Isn't that something? So I realized this as I'm driving, and I contact Chris, and I said, buddy, I said, I got to talk with you. And I made amends to him. You know, I told him that I was part of a 12-step program and I needed to make things right. And I went to my 20-year high school reunion not long after that. And he walks up to me, says, hey, are you still sober? And I says, yep, sure am. He reaches in his pocket and he pulls out a 6-month token. Yeah. That's just God showing off, man. You never really know when you're going to plant a seed with somebody. You know, sometimes this is the only big book anyone's ever going to see. And I want them to have a good experience, you know. I'll just say that, you know, my hope in every day of my life is that I don't have an AA life. I don't have a professional life. I don't have a personal life. It's all the same. You know, I like to show up in the same way everywhere I go. You know, for me, it's just a lot easier. I'm more transparent that way. I can be more honest that way. You know, so shortly after I got sober and I shut the business down, my sponsor said to me, he said, hey, John, weren't you in the military? And I says, yeah. And he says, don't you have a GI Bill? And I said, yeah, but I'm not a school guy. He says, I didn't ask you if you were. I said, why don't you just apply yourself? Just go. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, maybe I could be like an engineer or something like that. You know, so I went to college and took a career assessment test, and I'm trying to lie, because I really want to be an engineer. And I need some validation. I need something to tell me I'm supposed to be an engineer. And the top three things on that were like psychologist, social worker, or marriage therapist? Marriage therapist? They didn't ask me my relationship history on this thing. And I had this guidance counselor that absolutely loved veterans. And she said, John, she says, I know your type. She says, you're the type of guy, you're like a wind-up toy. She's like, I can just wind you up. I can put you right there. And I said, go. And she can say, go, and you're going to get it. I said, you're right. She said, I think you should be a marriage therapist. I don't know. I don't know. And so I just put one foot in front of the other. I started taking psychology classes. I graduated with a bachelor's in psychology. And when I was, then I immediately started my master's program in marriage and family therapy. And in the first semester, my son told me that he wanted to kill himself. And I realized that I had been telling him, just wait, son. Not now, son. Later, which is exactly what my dad told me, even in sobriety. And I realized that, you know, I needed to prioritize my son. And so I put a hold on school, and I got a job working in IT at the university. And I worked there for 3 years, you know, until he was stabilized and out on his own. And then I went back, and I finished it up. And when I... In the midst of the education, I'm required to go to do an internship. And the internship, it's just like any job. You do a job interview and all that. And they said, John, your resume looks good. Like, you know, we'd love to have you here, but we like to hire people that that have some other skill, you know, than just being a therapist. And I said, well, I just worked at IT for 3 years. They're like, great, you're hired. You can manage our website. You know, and I, you know how pissed off I was that God was having me do IT for 3 years? That, if anybody works IT, I hope you love it. It's the most miserable job in the world. I would work construction. I got to be outside. I got to move my hands. And all I did when IT is just sitting there waiting for something to break. And, man, I never know when God's preparing me for exactly what I've asked for. You know, and so I got that job, and ironically enough, every single day I drive right past the office where I had the interview that started it all. It's not the same company, because I would have went back and met amends, but it's something entirely different. I don't know the name of that company. And so in 2015, I went to the spring roundup, and I met a beautiful woman. And we ran the 10K. And I got first place for the men's, and she got first place for the women's. And we snapped a photo together. And at the time, despite the fact that I was sober, I still had a little bit of a wandering eye. I was dating somebody at the time, but the girl that had just won was really gorgeous. And I'm like, hey, like, what meetings did you go to? You know, and then I stay away. You're going to hear from her in 2 weeks. Then I stay away until I break up with the girl. And then I go to those meetings searching for her, you know. And then somebody else has swooped in and started dating her. And so long story short, we reconnected in 2019. And, you know, we started dating. And, you know, she didn't have any kids. I have a son. He's 28 years old now. And she said, you know, I'd like the opportunity to have kids, you know, and I got snipped, like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something like that. She's like, well, would you ever be open to adopting? And then all of a sudden, when she was 21 years old, she was too proud to accept payment from her parents to pay for college. So she went and donated her eggs, and a family, had the opportunity to have a child, actually have two children with her eggs. And, she came home from work one day and she said, John, she said, I need you to read an email. Wasn't expecting this. Said, we've got 7 embryos that we're going to donate to an adoption agency. One of those embryos is 3.5-year-old son at home. And I don't have a clue why I'm getting so emotional about this. But I can tell you that quite often I reflect back on all the women I dated. And I remember, what if God was preparing me for exactly what I asked for? Yep, I can look back. Oh yeah, I've dealt with that one because it's helping me here. You know, today I have a different mindset in life. I have a mindset, you know, I used to hate the month of November in recovery because gratitude. I hated it. Like, man, don't you know who I am? Negative Nick right here. And today I understand I have a daily practice of gratitude. I wake up every single day and I write roughly 10 things that I'm grateful for. And these aren't just things that I'm grateful right now. I'm grateful for things in the past. You know, I'm grateful for that person not hiring me. I'm grateful for wife number one cheating on me. You know, all the things that I'm grateful for because it has me right here today. Today my life looks totally different than it does when I walked in here. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist now. Those three divorces, I wasn't faithful to any of them. And in fact, number two, I was sleeping with the girl next door to us. I had a girlfriend in Alameda, and I was having sex with some girl on the base while I was married to her. And as it turns out that when I did all that, I have a unique ability to identify a cheater. You know, I've had the ability to call some people out when they walk into the room. You know, I remember the session one, somebody came in and I just had this weird inclination. And I said, hey, could I separate you two for a second? And it was the woman in the room. And I said, is there someone else? And she looked at me like she was what? You're not going to tell him, are you? I said, no, you are. Our program, our book says that our sordid past becomes our greatest asset, and that's true for me. I'm not bragging, I'm not trying to boast, but I'm really good at my job. And that has, you know, that truly has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with me trusting a higher power, trusting the direction of a sponsor telling me, hey, John, I know you don't want to do this, go do it. And way different. Prior to recovery, I had just filed bankruptcy, house foreclosed. You know, I was losing it all. You know, today, I own a beautiful house on a lake. I have a beautiful truck. A gorgeous wife, you're going to see her in 2 weeks. Glory hole. And that's the cash and prizes, you know. And when I was new, that was what I was attracted to. All the stuff, all the cash and prizes. But what I have today is far more than that. It's peace of mind. When I lay my head on the pillow at night, I go to sleep. I don't sit and ruminate. I don't think. I'm out. And that's the gift of this program, these steps. You know, my understanding of 10, 11, and 12, I heard them described initially when I came in the program as the maintenance steps. And then I later learned like that I don't want to maintain my sobriety. It tells me in 86 through 88, our next function is to grow in effectiveness and understanding. It tells, you know, on those pages, I don't know, it uses the word continue like six times or something like that. Continue to watch for things. Continue to grow. Continue to expand. And that's really what I try to do in this program. That is my daily effort. Today I have a spiritual practice that I prioritize connection with my higher power. As I said earlier, I start my morning with gratitude. I also believe that if I'm not progressing, if I'm not growing, if I'm not expanding, if I'm not offering more service to people, I'm just a taker. I'm just a taker. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous is way too valuable for that. You know, that son that wanted to kill himself, he's been sober for, he just celebrated 4 years in December. The 3.5-year-old is also sober. As far as I know. Yeah. Yeah, he's coming up on his 4-year cake. And I'm incredibly grateful that we have a sober household. You know, my wife and I, anytime we go out of town or go, if we travel internationally, we always make sure to get by the international plan so that way we can still have contact with our sponsees. We're still accessible. We have this rule that we answer the phone. You know, it's very simple. When it rings, we just answer it. I don't need to screen it. We answer the phone when we're on date night. Doesn't really matter. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't really care. And, you know, the last thing I'll say before I wrap up, my favorite line in the entire big book is on the top of page 20. And that's really how I try to live my life. It says, "Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs." Selfish, self-centered asshole like me, that is a foreign concept. You know, but there was somebody that stuck out their hand to me when I was new. Somebody that welcomed me. Somebody that left me feeling important. And, you know, and because I'm kind of more of an introvert, what I always try to do when I go to my home group or my meetings is I look for somebody who looks just as nervous as I do, staring at the ground, not the super happy guys. I go to the person who looks the most miserable in the room, and I try to, because I feel uncomfortable. And when I sit down and have a conversation with them, they don't feel so uncomfortable, and neither do I. You know, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous working for me. I'm a satisfied customer. I like the results produced by these steps, and I'm going to keep coming back. Thank you for letting me share.
I'd like to thank John from Menifee. Come back and see us again soon, probably in 2 weeks. I'd also like to thank the residents of our house and the Women's Auxiliary for another fantastic dinner. All right, and now we'll close in the usual manner with a prayer of our guest speaker's choice.